Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, December 31st, 2002. Today's session is Peace is the Way, Session 4, Peace with Enemy, an exploration of friendship, community, and the work of the loving kindred spirits, presented by Joyce Holliday and Mary Emily Wells. Let's listen in.
Our topic for this morning is Peace with Enemy. And I want to start by reading two short scriptures. I guess this is one of the classic Christmas scriptures to read this one. Again, very familiar from Matthew 6, verses 43 to 44. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. And then from Paul's second letter to the Corinthians, the end of the fifth chapter. From now on, therefore, we regard no one from a human point of view. Even though we once knew Christ from a human point of view, we know him no longer in that way. So if anyone is in Christ, there is a new creation. Everything old has passed away. See, everything has become new. All this is from God, who reconciled us to himself through Christ and has given us the ministry of reconciliation. That is, in Christ, God was reconciling the world to himself, not counting their trespasses against them, and entrusting the message of reconciliation to us. So we are ambassadors for Christ, since God is making his appeal through us. Be reconciled to God. For our sake, God made him to be sin who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. We began last night by asking the question, who is my neighbor? Since that was the topic last night, peace with neighbor, and I think that it's probably appropriate to begin this morning by asking the question, who is my enemy? I think that probably many of us may tend to think of ourselves as people who don't actually have enemies, that the concept of enemy is not always a particularly easy one for us. I just want to tell a brief story out of my time with Witness for Peace in Nicaragua, which was pretty eye-opening to me in terms of my own understanding of who my enemies are. Back in 1983, a group of us got together. This was when the Contra War was raging in Nicaragua. The United States was funding troops who had been part of the brutal National Guard under the Somoza dynasty in Nicaragua. After Somoza had been overthrown, the members of the National Guard went to cross the border into Honduras and then began training, and with the help of the United States, and probably would have been unable to do it without our tax dollars, formed themselves into a military force called the Contras. They began raiding villages in Nicaragua, and at one point a group of church people from North Carolina went down to the border area where the raids were taking place, and they realized that while they were there, the raids stopped, that the presence of North Americans was enough for the Contras to stop the terror that they were perpetrating there, because of course it would have been a very bad thing for publicity if there had been some kind of an incident with a U.S. citizen down there. So some of this group came to us at Sojourners, where I was at the time, and some other peace activist types, and said, you know, can we just get together for a weekend and talk about what we might do about this situation? And I still remember us all, October of 1983, sitting in a room in Philadelphia and deciding that if the presence of U.S. citizens was enough to stop the raids, that we should try to figure out a way to have a permanent presence of U.S. citizens in the war zones in Nicaragua. And somebody said, you mean we're going to ask people to go at their own expense to a place they've never been, to stand with people they don't know and risk their lives? And we said, yeah, we're going to do that. And in fact, that went on for several years and involved several thousands of people. expanded into other countries eventually. But those of us who were in that room decided that if we were going to ask other people to do this, we ought to be the first to do it ourselves. And so we went down in December of 1983 and went to a little town called Jalapa, which was on a little point of land that sort of jetted into Honduras. So it made this village particularly vulnerable to attacks by the Contras. And we set up a little peace vigil. Of course, we had these grand, noble ideas about how it was going to be when we got down there. We had studied a lot about nonviolent interposition, and we were going to go and stand between the Contras and the innocent Nicaraguans. And, you know, we got down there and asked them where the border was. Nobody knew where the border was. I mean, it was just, you know, mountains and mountains and mountains. And so it wasn't quite as dramatic as we had pictured, which was probably a good thing, but we decided that we would just set up a vigil in this little town and just be a presence there, as well as document the kind of atrocities that were being carried out by the Contra troops and attend funerals, of which there were many. And it really became a wonderful movement. But on that first night that we were there in Jalapa, I remember standing in the little town square and thinking, you know, this is so cool. Of course, I was like 23 at the time, I think, so, you know, I can be a little bit excused for my naivete. But, you know, it's like, here I am loving my enemies, you know? It's like, my country has declared the Nicaraguans my enemies, and I'm here standing with them, and they were sharing tortillas and coffee with us, and, you know, they're loving me, and, you know, isn't this wonderful? And, I mean, moments later, in my mind, I had leapt to thinking, you know, I really wish Ronald Reagan and Alexander Haig and all those guys could see us here and realize how consumed with hatred I was toward Reagan and those who were making the policy that had created this whole situation of the war there. Mm. And that, you know, the real enemies for me were not the Nicaraguans, and that there wasn't anything particularly noble, there wasn't anything honest in claiming that I was there loving my enemies, Now, the real challenge for me was to love the people who were behind the policy. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that this may be true for some of the rest of us as we look at our own current situation, that identifying who the real enemies are is pretty critical. Last night we looked at the passage from the Sermon on the Mount about the lilies of the field and the birds of the air, and, you know, sort of asked ourselves, what would the world look like if we really lived by that? And I think I'm pretty convinced that the world would be absolutely transformed if we Christians took that seriously. And I feel the same way about the Matthew 6, love your enemies passage, that if we even had an inkling of what that would be like, it would just bring dramatic change in the world. But we have very few models, I think, of what that really looks like, but I want to share with you this morning one that had a really dramatic impact on my life. I had the privilege of spending 6 weeks in 1997 observing the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. Just amazing. I mean, sometimes I just kind of lose words when I try to think about what that was about. That here it was essentially a whole nation, you know, which is not to say that everybody thought it was a good idea, but an entire nation that decided that instead of going to what usually happens with human nature, that place of vengeance and retaliation, that people who had been so persecuted, so tortured, so exploited, decided that they really wanted to have a national campaign of forgiveness. Originally, the idea was proposed by Nelson Mandela that there be a truth commission. Archbishop Desmond Tutu insisted that it be a truth and reconciliation commission, and that it wasn't enough just to have people telling the horrible things that had happened to them, but that it had to be done with the goal of there being reconciliation in the country. I had been in South Africa for the first time in 1989, when apartheid still had a stranglehold on that country, and church leaders and others were being imprisoned, and 10,000 children had been put in prison. And the brutality of that system was just so dramatic. And I remember on my first trip asking just about everybody I met whether they thought apartheid would end in their lifetime. And everybody said no. I mean, one woman said, maybe in my, probably not in my lifetime or my children's lifetime, but maybe my children's children's lifetime. So it was absolutely miraculous what happened there. And I think a lot of it had to do with this spirit of forgiveness. I spent part of my time in Cape Town where they were having medical hearings. They had different categories of hearings to look at how different sectors of the society had collaborated with apartheid. And in the case of the medical people, I mean, it was everything from just racial discrimination in people getting into medical schools to doctors collaborating in designing torture so to be the most painful that it could be. And one of the hearings I attended was around the death of Stephen Biko, who was the Black consciousness leader there and died in police custody. So it was really the beginning of truth beginning to surface and come out. Then I drove 10 hours into the interior of the country to a little town called Lady Brand. And there was a town hall there, which was absolutely packed with people. People had come from Bethuli, which was a township nearby, and you know, got there packed into cars and dilapidated buses and on foot and any way they could get there to tell their stories to the commission, which traveled around the country and set up hearings in different parts of the country, or people who had come simply to support the others in the telling of the stories. And I honestly don't know how the people on the commission were able to endure 2.5 years of hearing the stories. I do remember on the news seeing Archbishop Tutu just breaking down at one point and hearing a story. And I mean, I just felt like I wanted to weep the whole 6 weeks that I was there. As you know, you hear these stories of unbelievable tortures or people who had witnessed massacres or the worst kind of horrible brutalities that people endured. And yet, there was the sense that behind all this was a forgiveness toward the perpetrators. Often, people didn't know who it was who had committed the crime against them, so there wasn't really any direct, you know, one-on-one that happened between tortured and torturer, but in a very general sense, that was beginning to happen. There were several people I met whose, I guess part of what so disturbed me about my time there was I realized how weak my own definition of justice was and how I think from the time I was about 13, I feel like my life has been about justice, you know, I mean, that's been the thing that has motivated me. And to be in a situation where people's idea of justice had to do with how do we see the humanity in everybody? How do we receive everybody back into the human community? As opposed to how do we punish the people for what they have done to us? This concept of restorative justice. We restore everybody to the human community as opposed to the retributive, you know, how are we going to get back at the people who did these awful things to us?
And the fact of it was that if you said what you did, you couldn't be prosecuted for it, right?
That's right. There were specific criteria that you had to meet, but one was if you were someone who had committed a crime under the apartheid regime on either side, I mean, it was the security apparatus, the police, the enforcers of apartheid, but also the African National Congress and others on the other side, though by far the vast majority of the crimes have been committed on the side of the police and those. If you told the truth of what you had done, and if it was, you know, politically motivated, I mean, this wasn't just available to anybody who was a criminal, that it had to be related to apartheid, then you received amnesty. One of the sad things about that was that most of the people who came forward were people who had already been prosecuted and were in prison. And so there were still, you know, thousands of people who never came forward, never participated in the process, essentially hoping never to be found out. And
there wasn't anything, any way to do anything about that.
No.
There was a loop. There was a large loophole.
That's right. That's right. And for those who had problems with the way it was set up, probably the largest dissatisfaction that was expressed to me, and I really understand this, is that among those criteria, what was not required was any remorse. Mm-hmm. You didn't have to be sorry about it. You know, you didn't have to feel bad about it, as long as you confessed that you had done it. And to me, one of the great griefs was to see all of these people just telling these stories and exposing themselves to, you know, something new happening, and yet so little response from the whites. Everybody would tell me the story of Brian Mitchell. You know, they'd say, "Have you heard about Brian Mitchell?" You know? I finally realized that Brian Mitchell was such a big deal because Brian Mitchell was the only white guy who took any responsibility, you know, as far as I was hearing, for what he had done. He had been a police officer. He had been ordered to throw a grenade into a home, you know, squatter camp. The rumor was that this was an ANC stronghold and there was a meeting that was going to go on in there. He threw the grenade into the house. Turned out that this meeting was actually a wake. It was a family that was dealing with the death of a parent, and Brian Mitchell did feel remorse, apologized, went back to the village, you know, this squatter camp where it had happened, and said that he wanted to take responsibility for what he had done. And the leaders of this camp said, "Well, when you have hurt one of us, you've hurt all of us, and you need to say this to the whole town." And he did. I mean, he got stood up in front of everybody. He had no money because he had been actually put in jail for this. But he said that when he got out and when he got a job, he wanted to start a fund for the education of the children who had survived this bomb blast but ended up losing both of their parents, the one who the funeral was for, and I think it was the father who was killed by the grenade. That was the hope, you know, that there would be some sense of people being moved by this incredibly powerful, poignant thing that was going on, but so rarely did that happen on the side of the whites. But nonetheless, though not ideal, it is a miracle that South Africa did not just become this spiral of bloodshed, as happens in most countries in this kind of situation. I mean, whites were absolutely terrified. The big thing everybody was saying is they're just going to push us into the sea. And I had spent enough time in South Africa to think that if I was a black person in South Africa, that's exactly what I would have wanted to do with the whites. Which is why, to me, you know, that people found this strength out of their faith to forgive was just astounding to me. Two people in particular who stay with me. One is a woman named Maud. I met her in a kind of retirement center outside of Cape Town, and she told me her story, which is a horrible story and yet a very typical story. She was living in an area back in the 1960s that was declared a white area under the Group Areas Act. In the middle of the night, police came in a truck with guns, forced her and her family into the back of the truck, drove them out to the middle of the bush, and dumped them there, which was the beginning of the squatter camps. Left them with absolutely nothing. Her mother died very soon after that because she just couldn't carry the grief of what had happened to them in this displacement. And I asked Maud if she felt bitter, you know, about what had happened to her, that she had lost everything. And her response was, well, I know, or I guess I asked her if she had forgiven the people who had done this to her. And she said, "I don't know if I have forgiven them," which I thought was a very honest answer. Mm-hmm. "But I know that if I want God to forgive me, I need to forgive them." And I remember I just kind of wanted to take this woman by the shoulders and, you know, shake her or something. I mean, you know, and say, I mean, I didn't know her life, but I can't imagine anything that she did that even came close to what was done to her and the ways that she was violated and exploited. But it really was this 2 Corinthians 5 thing of, you know, looking at everyone through the eyes of Christ, and her having this sense that her own sin was as bad as anything that had been done to her. And that was sort of the prevailing thing, this understanding of we're kind of all in this together. When I was in South Africa the first time, I was visiting a black township called Duncan Village, and at this time it was actually illegal for whites to be in black areas unless you were a police officer in the army or something. And this young man named Jam Jam, who was showing me around, and I and a couple other people with us were picked up by the police, and, you know, I mean, they came in this huge armored personnel carrier, and it's all about scaring people, you know. And they took us to this room and brought in the security police and interrogated us. And I mean, I was very aware that as a white North American, I was going to be okay, but they were very, very threatening to Jam Jam, and he had just spent 10 months in police detention where he had been severely tortured and kept in a cold cell and fed only cornmeal infested with worms for the whole time. And they were threatening to put him back into detention, this security officer. And I was just this amazing moment in the middle of all these threats that Jam Jam reached in his back pocket and took out his small New Testament and just put it into the face of this officer and said, "Sir, I am a Christian." And the guy didn't know what to do. I mean, it was just like the power of the gospel confronting the arrogance of evil. And it was just quiet for a while. And finally, the guy just let us go. And Jam Jam went into hiding. And he was very, you know, he had lots of places. He had a whole network of places where he would hide. But before he left us, you know, I just asked him why he would risk showing us around, knowing that he was making himself very visible to this kind of brutality. And he said, you know, the whites are victims of the system too. Mm-hmm. In fact, they're bigger victims than we are, because at least we still have our humanity. Mm-hmm. And he talked about even P.W. Botha, who was the president at the time, being a victim of a system of apartheid, which is true, you know, mm-hmm. but it's like so hard for me to get there and to... The truly loving spirit with which he said that toward, toward the enemies. Charles Villavicencio, who was one of the people documenting the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, a white pastor, said that in the same way that there's the image of God in all of us, there is a bit of the perpetrator in all of us. And I think that was part of the insight as well, that people were beginning to see. And the other person that I want to just mention is Michael Lapsley. He was a chaplain to the ANC while it was in exile. Back in 1990, opened a letter that had been sent to him, and it turned out to be a letter bomb. Blew off both of his arms and blew out his eardrums and did some kind of minor brain damage. I was interviewing him several years after this had happened, and he talked about the feeling of not wanting to live. I mean, he didn't know how he could live without arms. He didn't know anybody who didn't have arms. The absolute bitterness that consumed him in the first couple of years after this had happened to him. And then coming to the insight that as long as he was bitter, the enemy had won. You know, they had accomplished what they set out to do, which was to make him angry, to make him lose hope, to make him give up on what he was doing. And he finally realized that to continue as he was to allow himself to be a prisoner of the enemy and of his own hatred of them, and that the only way for him to find any kind of liberation or live any kind of a humane life was to find a way to forgive them for what they had done to him. And, you know, just talk very powerfully about that turning point in his life when he was able to do that. And in a similar kind of insight, it was interesting to me that, you know, here was Charles Villavicencio, who is this sort of high-powered professor, and Michael Lapsley, who's this chaplain, and Maud, who's just a very simple woman living in this retirement center, that all had this same sense that the image of God resides in everybody, the capacity to do evil and be a perpetrator resides in everybody, and that the only way we're going to get through this mess is to recognize that we all indeed are in this together, and we need to be forgiving toward one another. And let me just end, and then I'll turn it over to Emily in my part by talking about one of the villages that I'd heard of in South Africa. I didn't visit there, and I'm actually forgetting the name of the village, but part of the understanding of that village, whenever anyone violated the village in any way, you know, harmed another person or stole something or whatever, they would call a big meeting of the whole village, and they would make the person stand in the middle of this meeting. And the task for the village was to address that person directly and tell that person every good thing they knew about that person and every good thing they had ever done. And remind them of their connection and of their humanity. And sometimes it went on for days, as people would do this. That was the punishment. And I just, I begin to think, what would the world look like if we did that instead of got into our punitive, three strikes and you're out, two strikes and you're out, or we're going to come and bomb the hell out of you and your country kind of stuff. Yeah. What if we actually thought about what is good in everybody, and actually loved our enemies? What would the world look like?
Was that common practice, or just something that village came up with?
I think that it was common practice in the particular tribe, and there are 13 different tribal languages in South Africa, and I don't remember which of the tribes or languages does it, but I think I have that right, that it was among them. So it wouldn't have just been that village, but the...
Yeah, that's neat. That's something.
Yeah. That's pretty interesting. Actually, I guess we decided we did this last night. Why don't we take a little time just to discuss the scripture and what I've shared, and then Emily will jump in with her poem after we've had a little bit of time to discuss this part of it.
This tribe reminds me a lot of youth work. You're able to, you set up a youth group as if you get put down by anyone, whether sarcastically or verbally or in some kind of physical way, you can demand of that person 3 put-ups. And that person then needs to tell you 3 genuine things that they admire about you, and it works. I mean, it builds a very different trust within the youth group. And it also requires that if I'm the one that is put down, I'm the one that needs to say, no, you owe me 3.
Yeah.
Because I think that's equally as important, is to say, no, I won't put up with that. Mm-hmm. And most of the time they start with just, real fun teasing things, and the put-ups are pretty, you've got pretty hair and nice eyes and I like your sweater. But when you continue to act that way, it's a healthy, builds a real healthy group.
I've read that it's a traditional way also in a West African country or community, that if there's harm done in the community, that the offender, that the person would be placed in a small hut in the center of the village. And all throughout that day, all villagers were encouraged to stop by and spend time with that person, reminding them of their connection and of their goodness. And then the day ends with the elders of the village meeting with that person and his or her family, to sense a sense of remorse and true accountability for what they've done, and then an offering of a gift to the family that had been offended, that had been victims, and that gift depended on the severity, whether it was a theft or a rape or perhaps even a murder.
And then if that gift was accepted, it ended with a full village feast where the food that was gifted was shared by everyone as a celebration of everyone coming back together again. So I think that there is some real wisdom in indigenous ways, in old ways of dealing with harm with one another. It makes a lot of sense that many of us have gotten far, far, far away from.
And the focus on these methods that we've been hearing is always community. I mean, it's based in a sense of the essential. The community is essential to our spirit and well-being and feeling. I mean, being whole.
Yeah. And a clear sense of where the offense is. You were bringing up as well that I'm always amazed, the times that I've been arrested. When I was arrested in D.C., because it's a federal territory, it was always the United States against Joyce Holliday. It's kind of this overwhelming, or if it was in a state, the state of North Carolina against, Well, the offense that I did was not an offense against the United States or North Carolina or someone who steals from somebody. It's an offense against that person. And I'm very excited about the whole restorative justice movement, because I think it's really an attempt to get to that place of making the reparation where it counts, putting it on that person to go and make right in the relationship that was offended, as opposed to turning it into this big court trial that involves all these people who had nothing to do with it.
And it involves sending someone away or out of the community.
Yeah.
And then when they come back, nothing's changed.
Right. And where they're likely to get more alienated and more. Yeah.
And then you'll have real enemies then.
Yeah.
For real enemies, I don't know what that means. But to get back to the idea of it's hard to identify our enemies in our culture, I have a hard time with that too. Well, it's easy enough to identify George W. Bush, or some people call some other names, but that seems to me like too abstract in a way. Is that really an enemy, or is that like can you assist in being an enemy? Or it's an interesting question. I'd like to hear what other people think of that. Do you know what I mean? Because I was very intrigued about the idea of the white people in South Africa being part of the system, because they all grow up indoctrinated into a system of racial hatred in amongst many groups, not just white and black. Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Mm-hmm. My first thought when you said, well, who is your enemy? Like, who is your neighbor? And the first thing that popped into my head was anybody that doesn't agree with me. Mm-hmm. And it can start very small. It doesn't have to be very big. And I was thinking about what you said about that village and what Tim had said as well. And I'm thinking, wow, what kind of transformation that would be if I was to teach my daughter that kind of attitude, that when instead of, okay, you've done this, and then getting friends or people to come and tell her what, that whole, how that would work. That would be very transforming. Mm-hmm. And starting with us, but I think Christians can have enemies with Christians because they're not agreeing with each other. And well, there's wide variety, but yeah. It doesn't have to be pretty abstract, and it just keeps growing. So if you don't agree with someone, then it just keeps growing.
I'm going to throw one more thing into the mix here for people to think about. Feel free to keep talking about things that are already on your mind. I was struck by what you said about the difference between an abstract enemy and a concrete one. I think, at least for myself, it's easier for me to have abstract enemies. But even just hating an idea, you know, this war on terrorism. We sort of set up an enemy for ourselves, but there's nothing concrete about it, and so there's nothing to forgive. There's nothing to work through.
Good point.
And even in slightly more concrete terms, with the present situation, even President Bush is sort of an abstract idea in a sense, because I'm so far away, I don't know him. So this is a poem sort of about what it might mean to make our, how it might be transformed if we saw our enemies as something concrete that we could then get to know on human terms and understand. I'll just throw this into the conversation. It's called For the Unknown Enemy. It's by William Stafford. This monument is for the unknown good in our enemies. Like a picture, their life began to appear. They gathered at home in the evening and sang. Above their fields, they saw a new sky. A holiday came, and they carried the baby to the park for a party. Sunlight surrounded them. Here we glimpse what our minds long turned away from. The great mutual blindness darkened that sunlight in the park and the sky that was new and the holidays. This monument says that one afternoon we stood here letting a part of our minds escape, and they came back, but different. Enemy, one day we'd glimpsed your life. This monument is for you. The first time I read this poem, I thought quite abstractly about who it was about. I sort of had like this other country in mind, you know, people that we didn't, you know, foreigners, people we didn't really know. As I started to read it again, I started sort of inserting my personal enemies into the poem. What might it mean if these people that I carry hatred for, if I really saw their humanity, what it is they're like? I'll read it one more time. See if you can think more concretely about who this is, people in your life or situations in your life. This monument is for the unknown good in our enemies. Like a picture, their life began to appear. They gathered at home in the evening and sang. Above their fields, they saw a new sky. A holiday came and they carried the baby to the park for a party. Sunlight surrounded them. Here we glimpse what our minds long turned away from. The great mutual blindness darkened that sunlight in the park and the new sky and the sky that was new and the holidays. This monument says that one afternoon we stood here letting a part of our minds escape. They came back, but different. Enemy, one day we glimpsed your life. This monument is for you. Any first reactions to that, or feel free just to sort of insert that into the mix of things.
I'm remembering that scene in Sophie's Choice when, I think it's Sophie's Choice, where they show the Nazi prison guards, they're going to their family to have dinner, and just across the fence is what's happening to Sophie and all the prisoners. And I'm thinking that part of forgiveness has to be partly this, to see the human side of them, that they take their babies to park and celebrate. And that must be one of the ingredients in the formula or the recipe for forgiveness. But a lot of the other ingredients I find pretty elusive. And you talk about some of these things you're talking about. And I also was in some of those areas and saw, surprisingly, that like the Nicaraguans when we were there, also at that time, a couple of different times, they didn't seem like they hated us, even though at times when we were in part of our programs, it was clear what we were doing. But at other times, when I was around the country along the borders where the war was happening, they didn't know who I was. And I used to wear a beret at that time. And I had a little pin on, and it was a Buddhist pin. It was the Knot of Eternity. But I think for anybody that might be looking around, it might look like I was U.S. military. And people would come up and ask, many things, like, how come the people are doing this? Because, you know, all the weaponry cartons and cases along the hillsides were U.S. and they were bombing the nutrition centers. But they didn't seem like they had this deep, deep hatred. And I thought, wow, I wonder how they're accomplishing that. That would have torn me apart, even thinking I might have been a part of that. And I wasn't sure. Partly I thought, well, gee, maybe it's because they have community that is healing them as they're going along, and they're not building up this big backlog of hatred and wanting for revenge. Maybe it's that they live so close to the land, and the land rejuvenates them. They're close to the sacredness of the land. And so I began to think, what is it that allows you to get to a point where you can forgive when someone's blown your arms off or killed your children, the massacres in El Salvador when you were involved with that? And for me, it got to a point where it was such a backlog of wanting revenge and not being able to forgive that I burned out. Many of us did burn out. And we became so, I think I did at least, became so angry that I couldn't be effectively part of the work. I was just glad when anything violent would happen to the other, to our side, to us. Mm-hmm. And so, I'm just putting it together, how do you keep from, you said you couldn't imagine how they could listen to the Truth and Reconciliation over that period of time. And I'm sure that part of it is grace, so I don't know exactly what that is, you know, from the 12-step meeting. I know that that's a big part of recovery, is that you have to be receptive to whatever grace is, because you can't do it alone. You can't forgive. But another part that I'm wondering, I don't want to keep, such a big concept, is that I wonder about the biochemistry of it, because, and even like depression has a lot of biochemistry around it, obviously. And this thing of being involved in this type of horror, Nita's done work with some of the psychology that goes along with some of the new approaches to helping people who have been in horror, with that work that's done with EMDR and that type of approach to shock and PTSD and child abuse. And if there's something that's happening biochemically when you're involved in this type of stuff, and then I'm just wondering what ingredient in the formula or the recipe for forgiveness is that? How much do we have to approach? We had a clinic for refugees of Central America, and a lot of those kids were victims of torture. They'd have the cigarette and the cigar stuff from foot to, you know, head to foot all over them, or they put out the ashes on the kids. And so the biochemistry of that is that has to be something that I wonder too, that has to be looked at. So I wonder what the ingredients are, you know, to the recipe. Because grace is great to say, but so I'm just kind of working this out, because it could be increasingly important to have things could get a lot worse before we're through.
Yeah.
And a whole lot more backlog for hatred and want revenge. And
you're looking for more concrete methods on dealing with people in those situations. More as someone that comes in as almost as a doctor or a healer, you know, to try to work with people in those, you know, other situations.
But also for ourselves. I think there's a lot of people in this room that have.
Yeah. I mean, I want that too. That's the question I came away with. Like, how did these people get there? Because I'm not there. And I don't know how to get there. You know, and I mean, I think they would say, but I'm still trying to, you know, work this out in my, I mean, maybe I'm trying to work it out in my head and I need to be working it out in my heart. Maybe that's part of the problem. But people would say, as Michael Lapsley said, that it is in their own self-interest to be forgiving. Mm-hmm. That, you know, they can somehow get themselves to the point of saying, what do I want the world to look like that I want to live in? Mm-hmm. And is it going to help me to harbor this hatred, mm-hmm, or retaliate? Or is the world going to be a better place, you know, not only for the perpetrators, but for me, if I can forgive them and restore them to the community and experience some healing. And yeah, but there's a shift in their spirit that has happened. And I mean, to me, this is most embodied in Desmond Tutu, mm-hmm. who, I mean, unlike most people in the kind of positions that he's in, I kept looking. I've had the opportunity to encounter him in several places, including getting to interview him at his home in Cape Town. And I keep looking for, you know, where's the inauthentic thing? You know, where's the? But to be in the presence of that man, you know, is I think what makes him a world-class Christian, or you know, whatever you want to call it, is that he has gotten to that point. He knows the answer to your question, and I don't. And I would like
Thomas,
to know.
I remember Thomas Borges in Nicaragua.
Yeah.
He was taken prisoner, and so they had him witness what they did to her repeatedly and over and over again, and then they killed her, and when he got out, he had done this trick. I don't know what it is that we're talking about, where he didn't. His expression was no, you know. I'm not going to go wreak havoc on them. Look at what they're already dealing with in themselves. Why would anybody need to wreak more havoc on them?
Right.
You know? And he had done it somehow.
Yeah.
And so grace has to be big.
And really looking at humanity, at people's humanity, it reminds me of Ireland, you know, and the long-standing hatreds. And the Irish can say, okay, we don't want to do that anymore. Wow, you know, what a place that is. And I guess it does speak to your idea of it's of self-interest that is good for all of us, and what kind of world do we want to live in? Well, you know, yes, I know that this group of people killed many people in my family, but that's not the world I want to live in. So let's see each other as fully human and start from there, which gets back to the idea of a system. There are people who are in a system. You can see people as humans who are being impacted by a system. So that's part of it too, of seeing people too.
Yeah. And to go back to the thing of seeing people as victims, I guess that's the other thing. I mean, the closest I've come to this in my own personal experience has been my relationship with my father. And I realized that the point at which I could forgive my father was when I stopped being angry at him and I started to pity him. You know, which is not a particularly healthy emotion either, but you know, I finally sat down one day and I tried to imagine what it was like to have grown up as my father, the youngest of a bunch of sons in a very poor family during the Depression with a very abusive father, and you know, sort of go through, okay, so this is why my father is who my father is, and this is why my father has treated us the way he treated us. And it has taken me, you know, most of my lifetime to get to this point. My father died in February, but somehow at the point that he died, I felt very differently about him than I had even a year before, because when I knew that he was very sick, I felt like it is incumbent on me to get to some different place in my relationship with him before he dies. And it's still hard for me to say that, you know, I really love him or I've completely forgiven him, but I feel like I'm pretty close, you know, and the only thing that has brought that change in my spirit is to just stop being angry, stop thinking just about me and the violations that were done to me and my sisters and my mother, and start thinking about what was his life like. And I think that's what Jam Jam was saying about P.W. Botha, you know, what was his life? How did he become a victim of this system so that he has become such a dehumanized person?
But he isn't dehumanized, so that's human to be, mm-hmm. to be for the system to twist you into thinking things that we think are human.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Sorry for interrupting, but it's just really struck me.
I have a comment with regard to, are we really talking about the sovereignty of God and those villagers, or Reverend Tutu, and the peace of God and the understanding? I mean, those villagers having the peace of God. Now, maybe not being able to articulate it and to intellectualize it, but they have the peace of God in that experience, and perhaps Desmond Tutu's got the understanding of the sovereignty of God in all things, therefore having the peace of God and understanding that there's something else going on through weaving through all of this that we're experiencing and struggling with. And that's really getting to the essence of what we're talking about, and to over-intellectualize it, I think, tends to not accept it.
Yeah, going on with what you said and backing up Tom's comment, when he was talking about the husband and who had seen his wife being violated, and then the thing that came to my mind was Jesus saying, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Mm-hmm. And maybe it's, you know, it kind of goes with your sovereignty, and maybe it's a sense of pity, but I don't think so. But there is that when we don't understand what or why or how, you have choices to make, and you can, I think these people, including myself, it's hard to understand. I don't have an answer, but it doesn't make any sense to me to just keep fighting and keep fighting and keep fighting, because it's not solving, it's not ending the it's not making any kind of resolution. So something's got to be different. And I can't tell you what it is. If I knew, I'd tell you. But I don't have the answer. But I'm not going to stop with that hope. And having that hope that there's going to be something that come out. But to have that forgiveness, you have to have that sense of... And it's not an all thing. I'm sure that this gentleman did not feel hurt and was totally cold about that whole thing, and that it didn't hurt him, and it had to have been a process, and you just keep growing and growing and growing into it as you can, your hatred can keep growing and growing and growing. So it's a choice of saying, you know what, I don't want, I mean, the gentleman with the arms, it's you have to turn and say, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm going to break the cycle. I'm stopping it and choosing to do something different.
It's like there's kind of, you know, two paths you can go down. And mm-hmm. You can either go down the path like the man with no arms. I think of times in my life when, I mean, I haven't had the horrible experiences that someone who's had their arms blown off or someone who's seen their whole family blown off. I have not seen that in my life, but when I have the few small incidences that I've had in my life where I have felt I have the reason to hate someone, that hatred just ate me up inside, and the more I continued to be angry and hate them, the more I became more like them, and the more that I started to turn into everything that I resented about who they were. And the moment that I was able to let go of that and release that and to decide to forgive them and love them, it was so freeing. And you just come to a point where, especially I think if you're living a life where there's so much trauma around you, that's the only way you can cope. It's either you become one of them and go crazy because of it, because there's no way you can possibly change everything that's coming at you, or you just come to a point where there's something in the core of all of us, I think, that's in every human being, and I think that's God, that's within us saying, no, that's not who you are. That's not your authentic self. Your authentic self is a loving being. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that's where that comes from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I appreciate the comments that I think have brought us again back to that scripture about we once regarded people from a human point of view, but now we look at the world through the eyes of Christ and we become a new creation. I mean, I think it's that radical. You know, we have to have everything just broken open to move out of normal human reaction, which is the anger or the hatred or the desire for retaliation, and become something completely new and really open our spirits to that and recognize that that's got to be God. You know, that's got to be a power beyond ourselves, because we can't will ourselves to the answer, you know, will ourselves to that place. It is time for us to break, coffee break, but we will, the next session at 10:45, we'll pick up on this and, you know, be sort of continuation, and I think it, there in particular, we'll try to take some of what we're talking about into the international setting and talk some about our responses to this impending war and how we might take some of what we've learned into our discussion about that.